Welcome to episode 64 of Central Intelligence Cinema. Today, we are bringing you our Brush Pass style review of 1985's Gotcha, starring Anthony Edwards and Linda Fiorentino. But without further ado, take it away, Pierce.
Beg your pardon, forgot to knock.
Welcome to the CIC, initiating security clearance.
My name is Napoleon Solo.
Bond. James Bond.
Natasha Romanoff.
Ethan Hunt.
Felix Leiter.
Elsa Faust. Identity confirmed.
Now, pay attention, 007.
Welcome to Central Intelligence Cinema, a podcast dedicated to spy movies and secret agent pop culture.
Your mission, should you decide to accept it.
Do you expect me to talk?
I'm in the middle of an interrogation. This moron is giving me everything.
Yeah, baby!
Special agent, you're not having a very special day, are you?
But remember, nothing ever goes according to plan.
Tom, what do you think you're doing?
Keeping the British hand up, sir.
The state will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Recording from an undisclosed location, we're saying my pencil is yellow, my pencil is long, may come in handy in some circumstances. It's a Central Intelligence Cinema Podcast. I'm Jason Greenberg, and with me, as always, Ben Esslinger.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Jason. And welcome back to the CIC, the spy movie podcast that always serves Pernod avec de l'eau.
Oui.
Oui. But we are back with one of our Brush Pass reviews for the uninitiated. It's our slightly briefer version of our normal overindulgent reviews. But grab your passport, your student ID, and a paintball gun, because today we're playing Gotcha.
Woohoo! Woohoo! Gotcha!
Gotcha! So, we are going to review Gotcha.
And you've been excited about this.
I have been excited about it. I've been very excited. In fact, so excited that I watched it about a month and a half ago and I went, ooh, I don't know if I want to do a super in-depth review on this anymore.
You had your True Lies moment with this one, I think.
Indeed, indeed. Shall we get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
I was just wondering if you're doing anything Saturday night.
No, I don't think so.
Would you like to go out with me?
No.
Jonathan Moore is a young man with a problem.
You are without a doubt the biggest animal I have ever seen in my entire life.
Does that mean no?
He goes to Paris on vacation.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
He meets a mysterious woman.
I like virgins.
You do?
In an even more mysterious line of work.
What are you, a spy?
Yes, I am a spy.
He follows her to Berlin. Now the CIA is after him. The Russians are trying to kill him.
Russians?
He's having the vacation of a lifetime. If he lives.
Gotcha. Gotcha. You're a regular James Bond, man.
Gotcha.
Gotcha, released in 1985, just weeks before A View to a Kill was released in May. Whew. Bad timing for them, man.
I mean, all bad the good timing. Movies, all the get yeah, that a yes, bad timing, but all the good movies that were released in 1985, and this was one of the ones that wasn't. Although it does have its charms.
It has some charm, but you know. It was directed by Jeff Canoe, who did Revenge of the Nerds. That's his big claim to fame. And I think it shows in this movie quite a bit.
Yeah. Clearly Anthony Edwards was handpicked.
Yes, because he had just been in Revenge of the Nerds the year before. Canoe also directed Troop Beverly Hills and V.I. Warshawski. So, he sort of got his claim to fame or sort of got his break. He was the editor on the movie Ordinary People, which did win Best Picture.
Oh, you did?
When that came out. So that was in 1980. Subsequently, he is now currently more of an editor than he is a director. I think he might have worn out his welcome wagon. Just a hair.
Everybody needs to try a little thing. Yeah, sometimes there's it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, well, you know, this business, lots of ebbs and flows, a lot of, you know what have you.
At one point in time, I was a very solid line cook at a Burger King.
That's right.
I could have stayed in there and rode that to fame and fortune and glory, but decided that maybe I might want to do something that didn't involve using cooking fat and toasting machines.
You could have worked your way up to
I could have literally become the Burger King.
You could have.
Had I wanted to stick with it.
And that's where the big bucks start rolling.
Well, hell, I would have gotten money for this movie.
That's right.
Although technically, when this movie was made, I hadn't yet started working at Burger King, so maybe not.
You know, this really falls right into, I mean, just as Revenge of the Nerds is now perhaps one of the most poorly aged films from the 80s. I mean, you want to talk problematic. That is, that's a rough movie to watch now. This movie is less so, but still some.
Yes.
But definitely still somewhat problematic. It's deeply rooted in bad 80s habits.
Yes.
Bad 80s movies habits.
Yeah, that Hollywood started self-correcting on in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
But in the 80s was full effect. It's like we went through this whole 70s renaissance of films that were dark and gritty and were really talking about life. And by the end of it, we're all like, now we just need a bunch of happy shit to mildly offend people who may or may not be offended. And
yeah, there was a lot of hacky cheap shots, a lot of stereotypes, jokes based on racial stereotypes, and just really hacky, lazy.
Oh yeah. But stuff. I mean, it seemed, we talk about the teen movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
The teen movie was born in the 1980s.
Yes.
The girl has troubles getting the guy in Hilarity Ensues movie. The guy has trouble getting the girl in Hilarity Ensues movie.
Right.
And it's a variation of the boy meets girl theme.
Mm-hmm.
But played for yucks.
Yes.
With a lot of synthy poppy, new wavy music.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of angst. And as mentioned before, boobs.
Lots and lots of boobs.
Lots and lots of boobs.
Yeah. And this is no exception to the rule.
With the exception of not having a lot of boobs.
Not too much. No. It was written by Paul G. Hensler, who his claim to fame was he was a crew member on Apocalypse Now. And Dan Gordon has the main credit, which interestingly enough, we have talked about before on this show because he was the writer for The Assignment.
No porridge was consumed in the making of this motion picture.
Indeed, indeed. But Dan Gordon also wrote The Hurricane, Passenger 57, Wyatt Earp, and Surf Ninjas.
The all-time classic.
That's right. Interestingly enough, I found it interesting that Mr. Canoe did not edit this movie. That was done by Michael A. Stevenson, who actually has quite the chops on him. He did Annie, The Toy, Three Men and a Baby, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and the entire Honey, I Blew Up the series.
No.
So
interesting. But so. I wonder if we have a situation here like we kind of do with Spy Kids, though, where the director may have been driving a lot more of that editing than the editor was.
Probably. And it was one of those things, too. I'm sure editors have lots of editor friends. You want to hook up your buddy, get him some work.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit of that going on, too. As far as photography goes, the director of photography, this is his real name, folks. It's King Baggott, B-A-G-G-O-T, just for the record. He has done quite a few things, though. He shot Cheech and Chong's next movie. He did Dr. Detroit, The Last Starfighter, and Oh God, You Devil, to name just a few. And he's done some like music video stuff and that sort of thing. I actually thought the photography in this movie is not bad.
No, it really isn't.
You know, and some of the shots, particularly in Berlin, I liked the lighting and how they treated it everything.
Some good atmosphere in there.
Yeah, like it actually gave probably more credibility to the spy aspect of this movie than maybe deserved.
Definitely was not deserving.
But music wise the music was by Bill Conti, who had just done 4 years ago For Your Eyes Only. It's fine, but it's not great. We were talking during the movie, I feel like Bill Conti, he's just not my favorite, I guess.
No, I was saying earlier, his stuff seems more like it's more appropriate for TV.
Yeah, it certainly does.
The interstitial stuff.
Yeah.
Just feels very $6 million Manny to me.
Very much so. And strangely enough, I actually liked this soundtrack better than For Your Eyes Only, if I have to be honest, because that's one of my least liked soundtracks, actually, in the Bond franchise. But
now, the actual songs they put into the soundtrack, aside from the eponymous title song,
yes,
were actually pretty good.
Yeah, there were some good needle drops in there. I mean, it was a little over the top when Frankie Goes to Hollywood comes blaring on, but it was fitting.
right?
You know, there was a lot of stuff in there that was just, I mean, it was decent. I mean, I don't know. It's fine. It's fine. Oh boy, we got to talk about budget.
Let's do that.
This is the roughest part of this whole thing is that the budget was $12.5 million and the movie only made $10.8 million. So obviously this was a flop, but I think it had a life. It must have had a big life on home video.
I think
the fact that I know about this movie, the only reason I ever knew about this movie was from video rental places. Right. Like, I certainly didn't see it when it first came out, but I was of that generation where suddenly there was a mom and pop video rental store on every corner.
Oh, yeah. And I think I watched this for the first time on one of the cable networks at the time. And I know it was in heavy rotation for a while.
Yeah, yeah. So it definitely had legs after it hit the theater. It just probably didn't make any money beyond that. No, so
it's the kind of movie where if it had inconceivably been made in the 90s after it was less vogue to be that stupid, it probably would have got a lot of traction in VHS or DVD sales.
Absolutely.
It would have more than made its budget back above and beyond. But that wasn't a thing back in 85.
Yeah. As far as the main characters and whatnot, we've got Jonathan Moore, played by the great Anthony Edwards.
With a full head of hair, baby.
Yeah, I mean, he looked great. I mean, back then, he had all his hair still before the ER days.
Oh, man, it was a sight to behold.
Indeed. But for those who are not familiar with his resume, he was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Revenge of the Nerds, The Sure Thing, which is a great movie also.
It is a fantastic movie.
And, of course, the big one, he was Goose in Top Gun. He was also in Zodiac, which I actually really liked him in the Zodiac.
Yes.
He was really good in that one. And then, of course, the doctor that he played on ER for years and years and years. Perfectly cast, in my opinion. Like, he really does, in fact, look like Bambi in this movie. He looks completely naive, doesn't know what he's doing. He's out of his depth, and he plays it convincingly.
And charmingly in his own way.
Yeah, yeah. And probably just as good, if not better, I think, would be Sasha Banachek / Cheryl Brewster, played by Linda Fiorentino,
Of Linda Fiorentino fame,
Vision Quest, After Hours, The Last Seduction, Men in Black, and Dogma.
Which, by the way, absolutely the best part of Dogma.
Yes. I mean, honestly, I felt like she was the best part of this movie, too.
But she might actually be the best part of every movie that she's in.
That she's in, yeah. Well, you know. Yeah. From IMDb, there's a little fun fact that Jeff Kinnear initially sought after a European-born actress for the role of Sasha. But after watching an early cut of the movie Vision Quest, he was immediately interested in casting her. But he was worried about some sort of critical backlash on casting an American to play a Czechoslovakian girl. So he had the entire third act rewritten to reveal that Sasha was really an American CIA agent named Cheryl. I kind of wonder.
This feels made up to me. I mean, maybe not that the story that's being reported is made up, but that Kinnear made up a story about feeling that there was some sort of backlash. Who is going to give you backlash in 1985 about an American actress playing a Czechoslovakian?
Nobody.
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 It feels like he was trying to drum up some sort of like intrigue or something.
Right. Well, okay, so based on this, if this is in fact what Kinnear really did, I wonder how the original script would have ended.
How did it resolve itself?
Yes, exactly. If she's not a CIA agent, if she is in fact Czechoslovakian, how the hell did they end this movie initially?
Well, and also, if she was in fact truly Czechoslovakian, it makes no sense. Why would a Czechoslovakian be trying to get information out of East Germany?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's all.
There's some mushy mush going on there.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, too, this is not the most intricate and complicated spy movie.
It is not.
It is almost 50% spy movie, 50%, like we had mentioned before, like a teen sex comedy, quite honestly.
Pretty much.
You know, so other major characters we've got Manolo. I do like Manolo. He's fun. At the time, he was known as Nick Corey. He is now known as Zhu Garcia. His resume, he was in A Nightmare on Elm Street, Wildcats, Predator 2, Collateral Damage, and he did a ton of TV stuff. I just really liked him because I think I liked the character. I liked the fact that he was a true blue friend to Jonathan, always looking out for him, always kind of, you know, even though he was the quintessential cool guy, he never like dumped on his friend really.
No, I mean, like he was willing to leave the room, you know, stay out of the hotel room so right. Jonathan could get action on with Sasha.
Right, exactly.
You
know,
I was like, man, you got to take it someplace else and cool it. I got to hang out in our place too. There was none of that.
There was none of that going on. So I also really, really liked Al Moore, Jonathan's dad, played by the late, great Alex Rocco, who was in everything.
Oh, absolutely.
He was in The Godfather. He was in a couple episodes of Get Smart, a couple episodes of Mission Impossible. Great character actor. What I didn't like, though, and we talked about this while we were watching the movie, is this is one of those super duper stereotypical cliched 80s movie tropes where the parents are just dumb as rocks.
Yep.
And, you know, his dad is just kind of dumb as rocks, but at the same time, he's like smart, but stupid at the same time.
The mom is sort of dumb as rocks. The dad is more concerned about money than he is about everything else.
Right.
But also concerned with appearing to be more concerned about money
right.
than everything else, which is just about a stereotype from the 80s as the dumb dad.
Right. Exactly.
You had one or the other. He either was really stupid
right.
or was more concerned about one thing than his own kid, but didn't want his wife thinking that he was.
So then we've got Jonathan's mom, played by Marla Adams, who did a lot of soap opera stuff. I will say she hits the comedy, though, really well.
She does. She's got some good timing.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, we've talked about in previous episodes about how a lot of times the best comedy is when it's played absolutely straight.
Yep.
And that moment where she goes, a week in Paris, you'll be talking like Marcel Marceau. It's like, and she just plays it like, has no idea that Marcel Marceau is a mime.
Right.
So then we've got just a couple minor characters here. We've got Vlad, who is, I guess, the bad guy, but he's hardly a bad guy. He's just, he's barely necessary.
Not well, and I mean.
You literally don't know anything about what, other than he's a Russian, so he must be bad.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the 80s.
Right, exactly.
Russians were the equivalent of Nazis.
Right.
Not that I'm saying Russians are Nazis for any of our Russian listeners.
That's right.
I'm just saying that they were utilized in the same capacity that Nazis were in movies prior to the 80s.
Indeed. So he was played by Klaus Lowitsch.
I'll go with Lowitsch.
Klaus Lowitsch.
What's up, Klaus?
What up, Klaus? He was fine. He didn't have much to do. Other than wave a gun and shoot
mainly,
it.
His main shtick was, I look like a Russian bad guy.
Yeah, so look the part.
It's all visual.
Just look the part. And then I did want to point out the professor that we see at the beginning of the movie, played by David Wohl, was also a professor in Revenge of the Nerds. So we brought, Canoe brought him back in to the fold for that one. So we get into the pre-title sequence, and it's so silly. You know, we open up on UCLA and there's this guy, you know, walking to class or whatnot. And then the music kicks in and you see Jonathan Moore. You don't know what he's up to, but the music is kind of implying that, you know,
something sinister is about to happen.
Something sinister is about to happen. For sure. So he's, I don't know if they show him with the gun right away, but he brings up the little gotcha card of his nemesis, who's walking to class.
Right.
And he starts to follow him and like the guy stops and he like looks behind him to see if, and because he feels like maybe somebody's following him.
Yes.
And then Jonathan hides behind the little pillar and then we keep going. And then at some point he realizes that he's being followed by John. And then it turns into this chase across UCLA campus.
Yep.
With a guy waving a gun as he's running after some guy on a college campus. Now,
Like you do.
Now, I will say there were literally clubs like this all across the United States mm-hmm. on college campuses who actually did this shit. So this is definitely one of those only in the 80s types of situations.
Sure.
You know, we are the generation that didn't have helmets when we rode bicycles. We didn't wear protective padding whatsoever when we went skateboarding. This just,
yep. And you know, we walked around shooting each other with paintball guns.
Right. In broad daylight.
In broad daylight.
With
campus security is like, oh, they're just kids, man. Kids.
Just kidding.
Come on. It's not like it's a real gun.
It's not like there's live ammunition in there.
Come on.
It's fine. So anyway, All that aside. So now there's a full-on foot chase going on across the campus. And I do love there's this moment in it where the music, actually the music in this part I kind of like because it's timed up really well. There's a moment where...
Hey, watch it, man!
It's just timed very nicely. But yeah, so the kid that's being pursued, he pushes some guy out of the way, makes his way down this huge flight of steps, and Jonathan goes down the side, and he crosses paths at the end, kind of half pushes that girl out right. of the way, and she screams or whatever, and then he shoots the guy, and
and everybody gets hit with paintballs and falls so dramatically every right. time. Like it's the rules.
Right. Like it's, there's no way that thing would send you to the ground.
No, it would not. It would hurt, but you have, right. it's like, in the rules, it's like if you feel yourself hit by a paintball, you must fall to the ground as though you are dead.
Right. Because those are the rules which we have now just made up.
Right.
So the girl that he pushes out of the way is very upset. Very upset.
Very upset. Very, very what the character needed to be.
Yes, yes. She's this blonde.
She's Muffy, gag me to the max.
Yeah.
With her chenille sweater.
Yes.
And her mini skirt and her ankle-high socks.
Mm-hmm.
And her Diet Pepsi.
Yeah, very...
Very product placey Diet Pepsi.
Yeah, I even took note that they had the logo...
Oh, yeah.
...specifically pointed at the camera... So that you could read it in the shots.
But then...
In all the shots.
And then went on to then say, but don't get Diet Pepsi on your chenille sweater because it probably won't come out.
Right.
She had a hissy fit about it.
Yeah, she had a total hissy fit. And he's like, oh, no, it's fine. I didn't really kill him. He's fine. He's alive. It's just the game we play. And the guy that got hit, he's like complaining. He was all this close to getting away. So he walks off. We don't see him ever again. And then in the meantime, Jonathan's trying to apologize, trying to hook up with this girl, you know, says, how can I make it up to you? Well, I'll take you out to dinner. And of course, she plays the quintessential bitch.
Sure.
For lack of a better term.
She's the Muffy.
But this sort of brings up one of my bigger issues with this movie is it feels like every girl that isn't Sasha in this movie is just mean. It's just like a not nice person.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me ask questions about the writer and director. You know, like what... Why are we painting? Do we? Is it necessary to paint them? It's one thing to be mad and shell shocked by an right. ordeal that you're brought into. It's another when, you know, he's apologizing profusely. No one actually got hurt. Her sweater didn't look hardly touched at all.
Right.
Save for maybe a tiny, tiny sploosh of her soda or whatever.
Right.
And she makes it sound like, you know, she's been accosted.
So it's just that 80s stereotyping that's going on. You know, all of the characters in these movies, from Real Genius to here, they're all the disenfranchised nerd people because this is when nerd culture really started to be a thing.
Yeah, it's very tropey in that respect.
Exactly. And so those characters, I hate to say it, as problematic as Revenge of the Nerds is, an entire movie explains just about every movie from 1982 through maybe 1989.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And what the impetus is. There's this demographic of people that are very smart and good in their own little thing, but completely inept outside of it.
Sure.
And so they, unless they're with other people like them, they get treated as pariahs.
Right.
And so when you write about them, the people that have to antagonize them have to be 10 times as asshole or bitchy
right.
as a normal person would be to illustrate the point that they're so beat down upon.
Right.
And so, as being one of those nerds in that era, I can tell you there were some pretty bitchy fucking people.
I mean, I wasn't like a nerd in the stereotypical sense, but believe it or not, kids, when skateboarding first came out, it was not a thing that popular people did.
No.
It was the outcasts who did skateboarding. So that's where I was when I was doing that stuff. So I understand some of that. But it felt, in 2024, it feels very heavy-handed.
Absolutely.
And it feels like it paints women in a slightly unsavory light.
Yeah, but most movies in the 80s kind of did.
Yeah, yeah. So I digress. So then we get the titles, and it's just, you know, silly title, just gotcha with an exclamation point. Yeah,
don't forget the exclamation point.
That's right. It's not gotcha.
I didn't just gotcha. I gotcha.
That's right. That's right. So then we're getting all the title cards, and we get this montage of showing off that of the gotcha players on UCLA campus, Jonathan Moore is
He is the big king daddy of gotcha playing.
That is. I mean, he is up on top of rafters. He's, you know, hiding in trash cans. He's rolling down a wheelchair ramp in a wheelchair with a blanket on top of him so he can conceal his paintball gun so that he can shoot all these other guys. He is like gotcha's most wanted.
No doubt.
Like, and nobody seems to be able to catch him. We then get a moment where he finds himself being hunted by the guy in all jeans. All jeans.
Rowdy Piper Jr.
That's right. Looks like a roadie for Bon Jovi or something.
That's right. But he came here to play paintball and chew bubblegum, and he's all out of bubblegum.
And we see Jonathan hides in the bushes and gets away from him just that easy because...
He's Jonathan. King daddy of gotcha paintball game.
That's right. So after all the credits are done, we then see him walking up to class, and he's going up the stairs, and he finds some other girl that he's in a class with that assumedly would be maybe a little nicer to him, but no.
Nope.
He's like, hey, I'm how's it going? And she's like, and you are?
He's like, and this is regarding...
Right? And he's like, I'm Jonathan. Would you like to go out? And she's like, no.
Well, the best part is, she's like, are you doing anything tomorrow night? And she's like, no. Well, would you like to go out with me? No. So you're saying you'd rather do nothing than go out with me? Yeah.
Which is not an unacceptable answer. It's just...
What?
He kind of set himself up for that one a little bit.
He really did. And I mean, this was not a Muffy type girl. She just looked like a girl that was in his class.
Yeah.
And that one struck me as being more bitchy than the Muffy girl type character. Because she was just kind of an ordinary girl that was also giving him the fuck you finger and sending him on his way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Indeed.
And I'm sorry. Anthony Edwards is kind of a handsome dude.
He is kind of a handsome dude. I mean, that was the other part of this. And maybe that had something to do with the fact that he had just been in Revenge of the Nerds. And so there was that image of him in the zeitgeist at the time.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, we'll just continue that on for just a little bit until he grows his butterfly wings.
That's right. Like Tom Hanks started out being kind of the goofy nerd guy and eventually became Oscar winning Tom Hanks.
Right. Exactly.
In the '90s. Except we never got Oscar winning Anthony Edwards.
No.
We did get Emmy award.
We did get Emmy award win. Multiple Emmys.
Yeah. So, I mean,
so, you know, But I digress. So after he gets denied again, then he's walking down the hallway and he meets Manolo. And, you know, he's complaining about how he can't get a date. And Manolo's trying to give him some advice or whatever. And, oh, but they bring up the fact that he had just gotten chased by one of the other guys. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you're like a regular James Bond. So this is James Bond reference number one.
Sure.
And he's like, well, James Bond got pussy galore. I can't even get a date, you know, and that whole thing. So he's complaining about all this. So then they go to class and he's going to veterinary school. So in the most...
Like you do.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if an undergrad class would ever have a tiger in a cage in a veterinary class.
I mean, yeah, in a pre-med veterinary class.
Yeah.
I feel like they didn't really understand what going to college was in this movie. And how it works.
Yeah.
Like, they could have just said he was 23. And left it there.
They could have left it there and said that he was a post grad.
Right. And then it seems even worse that he hadn't gotten laid up until that point in time.
That would have made him look really pathetic. Right?
But I mean, by the same token, you're not going to have a tiger in a cage learning how to use tranquilizer darts in pre-vet med 101. And if he's 18, he ain't in anything but a 102 class. That's for sure.
Exactly. Well, and I think too, this whole movie, I feel like Canoe was mostly concerned with the comedy and romance of this movie.
Yes.
And far less concerned about the specifics of everything else.
Like, even, I don't know, the Central Intelligence Agency and how it actually works?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of those details, those extra tertiary things that don't get as much attention. It's like,
I need
attention.
This to be this way to move my plot forward, and so thus it is.
Right, and I need a punchline here or a lovey-dovey moment here, yep. And everything else can suffer, like, being cared for.
So it's sort of like he made a movie like Mission Impossible, where they just came up with some ideas there and then sort of tried to flesh out a story around it.
Yeah.
Not quite as successfully.
No.
But, so, you know... Tried and true.
Exactly. But I digress. But we're back. We're in class, and the teacher is showing how to use the tranquilizer gun, which, of course, you know, plays later. There's a whole reason why.
Foreshadowing.
Showing off where and how the tranquilizer gun is used and kept. And in the meantime, as the professor is lecturing, Jonathan continues his woe is me talk with Manolo. And right as there's a quiet moment in the class.
I don't know, Manolo. I think it's hopeless. I'm never going to get laid.
Although that thought may be a great comfort to the women of the world, Mr. Moore, as a future veterinarian, you should know that every dog eventually has his day.
Probably the best line in the movie, I think.
Right.
Thank God that the record scratching sound wasn't a thing there.
Yeah.
Because that totally would have been a...
Yeah.
Chirp, chirp, crickets. Chirp, chirp, chirp.
Right. Well, thankfully, I do think that despite the fact that he did want this to be a comedy, he also, so shockingly, actually, from the guy who did Revenge of the Nerds, showed a little bit of restraint here and there as far as not taking the comedy so far like you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he didn't quite push it so...
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head a couple minutes ago. He really wanted to make a funny movie that was a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And I think he was more focused on the romantic and spy stuff.
Yeah.
And the comedy sort of came along in the writing. I will tell you, there was not any point in this movie that I laughed out loud. I mean, none of the jokes are that funny.
No,
other
not really.
Than what the professor pops out.
Right.
Because it's a sick burn.
Right. There's a couple of moments coming up here, but yeah, it's few and far between. Most of the jokes are actually really hacky.
And also still stuck in my brain from 15. So,
yeah.
You know, the French pencil joke.
Yeah.
I've been using that for years.
Right.
You know, so a lot of that has just been so ingrained in my normal speak that it's just not funny to hear it.
That is very fair, because I think me too. I mean, this came out at the perfect age for me. I mean, I was in my early teens when I discovered this movie. And so I watched it over and over and over again when I was a kid, because it just had all the things that a dumb 13-year-old would want to watch. Sure. At the time, you know, growing up in the 80s. Now you watch it and you're like, okay, all right. Well, you know, it was funny at the time. Moving on. So during class, though, I should say, they mention the fact that spring break is about to come up. So you know that they're about to go on vacation to Europe.
Right.
So then as they're leaving, Manolo invites him to something, and Jonathan's like, well, I got to go to my parents. And Manolo's like, well, is your family okay with you going on vacation? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's fine. And then immediately you cut to Jonathan being at his parents' house. His dad's like, it's out of the question. Europe costs a fortune. And then they immediately cut to a wide shot of the backyard of their house with a nice pool. And then what's her name? Rosario comes up, their maid.
This is where we establish that
dad makes some money.
Dad makes some money, but doesn't like spending any of it except on himself.
Indeed. Yes. To buy his Nikon.
It's not a camera.
It's not a camera. It's a Nikon.
It's a Nikon. Also not waterproof. Stay tuned.
Yeah, we get a lot of just back and forth. His dad doesn't want to pay for it. And then, of course, Jonathan goes, Mom. And Mom goes, Al. You say Mom, you say Al, and it all comes out of my pocketbook.
Yep,
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Of course, that allows him to go. And then we get the same joke over again, only with being able to use the camera.
Honestly, I mean,
yeah.
The comedy writing maybe not as solid as Revenge of the Nerds.
Which is saying something. Yeah.
You know, and hot off the heels of having watched Top Secret, which had only come out a year before this.
Yeah.
And I will openly admit, I think I did on the podcast, wasn't really that funny, But at least it was a much more earnest attempt at being a funny than this one is.
I don't know. I still think Top Secret was pretty funny, but I digress.
You like that kind of humor, though.
I mean, I do. I like the silly.
It's your shtick.
It's the same reason why I like Roger Moore movies so much. Why I like the more Bond movies.
Yeah, and the reason why I dislike them so much. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about Gotcha some more.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's talk about Gotcha some more.
So after he leaves his parents, then I believe they're off to Europe, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they're off to Europe. They land in Paris, and we immediately get the anthem of France.
Well, apparently, and I caught this a couple times, but every time there's a new country, they will play the first few bars of whatever anthem is for the country they're in.
So that you know, pound you, beat you over the head with it.
Some people use incredibly large title cards to tell you when you're in France.
You know what? I much respect you, because I would much rather have a musical cue to inform me than some blatant giant like you're talking about. Yep. We're looking at you, Russo brothers. So
it didn't get to England, but you know, if they had, it would have been dun 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 dun.
Either that or another bad needle drop of London Calling.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh, God, they do that all the time and it's terrible. Anyway, so they're in France.
They're in France.
They're in Paris. And they're just like walking across the street somewhere in downtown Paris. I think you can see the Eiffel Tower in the background or whatever.
The real Eiffel Tower. Eiffel Tower placed in the Georgia suburb.
That's right.
They actually went to France for this one.
Yes, indeed. And, as they're walking, it's funny too, because this happens a couple times where Jonathan is gawking as this tourist at all the stuff around him, like, oh, the Louvre, you know, and all this stuff. And in the meantime, Manolo is just constantly checking out women. Just constant, because he's
Lothario, right?
He is, absolutely.
He's the one that gets lucky with the ladies, and right. Jonathan's the best friend that knows everything.
Right. So as they're walking across the street, of course, Manolo sees some very attractive young lady walking across the street, and he's like, oh, I want you to meet my friend. And then, of course, Jonathan comes over and says a horrible thing in front, like,
voulez-vous coucher avec moi, je sois?
Yeah.
That he picked up from a 70s disco tune.
Right, which he thought meant...
to go out on a date with me.
Yeah, which is not what that means.
It's not what it means.
Chris can attest. Hope you're still out there, Chris Ty. So then they go to the Louvre.
They go to the Louvre.
Yes. And they're walking around, and again, Jonathan's gawking at, I mean, this is where, you know, Napoleon turned this into the largest.
Yeah, it used to be before Versailles, and 280,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,
women.
Checking out the...
Finding the Swedish girl.
Swedish girl who actually turns out to be Swiss.
Yes. So he goes over there in his tight leather pants.
With pockets.
With pockets and his Ray-Bans from the 80s. And his moon boots. And his moon boots.
Got to get them moon boots in.
Moon boots. The moon boots play. So he talks to this girl and basically makes himself seem very dangerous to her. And that's very exciting
Carlos
to her.
Carlos the Jackal.
God, I know, right?
And it's funny. Carlos is in this movie.
Yeah.
Carlos is in The Assignment.
In The Assignment, there is. That couldn't be coincidence. Same writer. Just saying. So, he tells the woman that his name is Carlos and he's from Algeria.
You know, the only thing that would have made this even better is if Manolo's character had been played by the guy that played...
Oh, my God.
What is his name? Anthony... Aidan Quinn.
Aidan Quinn?
What if Aidan Quinn had played that character?
I wonder if the ages would have lined up.
I don't know. But probably not, but that I don't know. That.
Yeah.
That would have immediately made this movie 10 times better.
So at this point, Manolo goes off with this girl and he tells Jonathan, he's like, I need the...
Find something to do for a couple hours.
Find something to do a couple hours. I need the hotel to myself. He's like, go see the Eiffel Tower. And Jonathan's like, I've already seen it. And Manolo's like, see it again.
Right. And I'm like, you guys just got to the Louvre. You can't kill 2 hours in one of the greatest art museums in the world.
Right. You could spend a whole day in the Louvre.
Yeah. I could kill, like, literally, I don't need 2 hours. I could 2 weeks.
Yeah. Just to make it through the whole thing.
Right. So that's kind of funny. See the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. So then Jonathan winds up in some little French cafe bar thing, and we get that waiter scene, which is hacky, but also my teenage brain has it burned into it. It's just because there are some funny moments in here.
Sure.
Mainly at the expense of Jonathan, really.
It's true.
Where he asks for Pernod, and he pronounces it Pernod.
and then you get that stereotypical asshole French waiter.
Yes. Who's just like,
rien de ça, donnez-moi un, s'il vous plaît. I don't know what is Pernod.
Pernod, here. See.
Ah, un Pernod.
Pernod.
Monsieur wishes un Pernod.
Yes, monsieur does wish.
Do you take traveler's checks?
But then Anthony Edwards coming back with the kind of bitchy blah, 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 right back right, at him.
I know. It's like
fantastic.
Yeah. So we get that little moment that plays out, which is fun. And then what's really great is you see him have multiple drinks. And at this point, he's now got sort of Dutch courage going on.
Right.
Bernard. Avec de l'eau.
Mon crayon est large.
Pardon?
Mon crayon est large et mon crayon est jaune.
Your pencil is big and yellow?
Oui.
Oh, nice for you.
How nice for you.
How nice for you.
So then the waiter goes away, and finally, even though she's been there the whole time, Jonathan sees Sasha off a little ways away, and she's eyeing him. Yeah. Let's just have a moment of silence for
short-haired Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah. Okay, moving on.
All right, moving on.
All right, so Jonathan sees her, and he feels compelled with his Dutch courage in him now to walk on over and make an ass of himself, which is exactly what he does.
He's very good at that.
Very good at that, and fails, of course, the first time. He's like, can I get you something to drink? I'm already drinking coffee. You're very beautiful. Yes, I know.
Right.
Well, I just didn't want you to forget. I'll be seeing you later. And shooting myself in the face. He walks back to his seat. And then, of course, she comes back around and kind of hits on him and makes him feel better about himself. And then, you know, he starts to lie to her because he's telling her all the things that he thinks that she wants to hear, saying that he's 23 and not 18, that he's not a virgin.
Not a virgin.
And turns out that that's exactly what she's looking for.
Sure, a virgin.
A virgin.
An 18-year-old virgin.
Well, it's a little creepy because she really says 17, 18-year-olds.
Yes, she does.
And I'm just like, okay, 80s. It's the 80s, but still, this guy's reputation precedes him. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, he did effectively film a guy raping a girl who was then immediately okay with it because of his prowess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was also in a spy movie I saw somewhere.
Harumph. Moving right along. So they start to hit it off, and he says very sincerely, I would kill or die to make love to you or whatnot, because that was the line that Manolo fed him earlier. Sure. And somehow or another that works, mainly because she needs an asset.
Sure.
So they end up headed back to Jonathan's room. Why doesn't she have a place of her own?
I'm still trying to figure that out at this point.
Yeah.
I mean,
you would think, but maybe she's not trying to, she doesn't want to give anything away because she's the spy in this scenario. You know,
I'm going to go on a hypothesize here. Since it was clear that there was some sort of a expansion of Central Intelligence Agency operations in the United States of America, which is clearly illegal, that there just wasn't enough budget for her to maintain her cover as an actual student visiting from the United States in France, that she would actually have a hotel room. There just wasn't any money in the budget.
Of course not.
So why? She basically just walked around the streets
until of she Paris found someone.
Until she found a Mark, and then she could hang out at the Mark's place.
Sure, sure.
I mean, she had enough money to get a place in East Germany and regular Germany, right. But she didn't have enough money to, you know, get a place in France. She had to stay. Maybe she just didn't like Manolo. And she was like, let's keep Manolo out of here.
let's just keep him from getting
like those leather pants. They're not good.
It's not a good look.
It didn't stop Manolo from getting laid, though.
No, he just turned that other girl right back around.
Nancy Reagan or whoever that was in the red dress. Girl looked like she was probably 40. I don't even know. Go, Manolo. Cougar Town. But, you know, he was like, yeah. I think we should just go back to your place.
Yeah.
Why isn't anybody going back to the other people's places?
I don't know.
This is what I also don't understand. I know.
You two are sharing a room and you don't ever like go, hey, maybe we go to your place because I'm sharing a room with somebody.
Well, I almost kind of get it in Manolo's case because he's playing the Jekyll.
Right.
Right. So right. He's keeping some mystique.
The only thing I can think of with Jonathan's case is that she's trying to make him feel better about himself.
Yes.
By being okay with going to a room where...
She's definitely not trying to rock the boat in this case.
Yes, because she's clearly has an objective behind all of this.
Right.
So anyway, so they go back to his room and they kick Manolo out.
Off you go, laddie.
Which... We get some fun little banter in there, too. He's like, does Sasha have a friend? Hey, no offense, man, but she only likes guys that look like Bambi. You know, I can't be seen with Carlos the terrorist.
Right. You know, why don't you go see the Eiffel Tower? I've already seen the Eiffel Tower. Go again.
Exactly. So, and then sex happens.
It does.
Yeah, then sex happens. And
with no saxophone. Can I tell you, in an 80s movie, how refreshing it
was
to not have a sex scene with saxophone.
That's right.
I used to call them sax scenes.
You don't need
because it. Because it's almost in every single one of them.
You just don't need it, kids. I'm just saying. Don't.
Fortunately, most of their sex scenes were dialogue heavy and not gown chicka wow wow heavy.
Yeah. Well, there was that one where it was like during that montage later on where it's like, never could say goodbye. And like that whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But
better than sax, really. I mean,
yeah.
Better than sax.
Better than sax. The sax scene, yeah, for sure.
Sax is great, but have you tried vocals? Goodness. Okay. So Jonathan, him and Manolo are supposed to go off to Spain, but she, of course, has to go to Germany. And, you know, she's like, well, I, you don't have to go. It's fine. I don't care. I really don't care, even though, you know, I'm very sexy. So you want to come with me. So, of course, she goes with it.
Because he's not stupid. Goes with her. Because he's not stupid.
She's Linda Fiorentino with short hair looking amazing. And he's him.
So, Anthony Edwards in this case is us.
Is us.
He is us.
He is us. Even though in real life, Anthony Edwards at that time was a good looking fella.
He's still a good looking fella.
He's still a good looking
fella. You and I are still good looking fella.
That's right, damn it.
Linda Fiorentino would be lucky.
To not run into us.
Kind of thought that went without saying.
So,
onward to Berlin.
Onward to Berlin. Yeah, Jonathan says goodbye to Manolo, and Manolo's a little leery about the whole thing. He's like, I still think you're letting the little head think for the big head, but you know, Jonathan's not going to let that little pep talk stop him. So he's off to Berlin with Sasha.
They go to Germany. They go to the hotel. Check in as Mr. and Mrs. Banachek.
Right.
And
that's right. They pose as a married couple. But we get some more romancy filler type stuff, which is weird too, because there's not even dialogue going along with it. It's just music and montage of them walking and loving each other or whatnot.
Her sinking her teeth into him.
Exactly. And then one night in the middle of the night, she kind of slips out. And goes out to some street corner smoking a cigarette. And then this guy appears. And of course, we find out that's her contact.
Yeah, passphrase.
Passphrase. And where do you get the thing?
Here are some matches. Oh, I must pay you for them.
Right. And then there's the whole half dollar thing that they keep bringing up. And then she lets Jonathan know that she has to go to East Berlin. And he's like, what? So we find out that... She tells him that she's a courier and that she just needs to pick something up and then bring it back over. They don't tell her what it is or anything like that.
Right.
And Jonathan, being very enamored with Sasha, just sort of goes along with it.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have, but did.
Yeah, but did. So that's when they rent this car that is something. Yeah, I'm it's an interesting
sure it's
car.
It's a Citroën or a Peugeot of some sort.
Yeah.
But it is definitely 60s vintage.
Yeah, and doesn't fit in with any of the rest of the cars.
No.
Because all the other cars are like Mercedes and that type and of
Volkswagens,
thing.
Volkswagens, everything like that. Volvos
and
that
sort of thing. So anyway, they pack all their stuff into that and they head to the DDR checkpoint. And there's a guy taking a picture of them. Jonathan sees that and he freaks out and is not paying attention to what's directly in front of him. And then he's immediately stopped by the guard, who then whacks the front of the car with his baton and completely just...
Oh, yeah. He's just completely flustered and,
yeah,
and doesn't know what he's doing because he doesn't want to be going into East Germany.
Right. Because nobody wants to go to East Germany in the mid-80s.
No,
not if they don't have to, especially if you're American.
Exactly.
So they have that little minor dust up, but, you know, make it through. So after they're in East Germany, then we get this very unlikely sort of lovey-dovey montage where they're walking through the park, they're taking pictures, which you don't do in East Germany.
No. Not as an American taking pictures in East Germany.
There would be somebody walking around going that would yank the film out of your camera or just take the whole damn camera.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah. So,
but they're going down slides.
They're going down slides. Pictures. They're taking pictures.
It's love. I'm in love, and I don't care who knows it.
That's right. Never could say goodbye. So anyway, they're very much enamored with each other. And then at one point, they're walking, and they approach this kind of looks like a cafe or a supermarket or something. And she's like, "Well, I got to go pick up my stuff now. I'll meet back up with you." So she goes off to the little photo mat thing to get...
Which I'm sure they have plenty of in East Germany.
Right,
in
sure.
In the 80s.
Of course. So she turns in her little half dollar to her contact at the photo mat, who then gives her the roll of film that has quote-unquote spy shit on it. And meanwhile, she meets up with Jonathan back at this little restaurant place, drops her silverware on the ground... And who picks it up but Vlad?
Who has been periodically popping up and indicating he's following them around.
Yes.
And the fact that she doesn't spot him as a spook immediately.
Yeah.
I guess it sort of plays to the fact that this is like her first big assignment, which we find out later. But right there, if she'd been trained in anything, she'd have seen he was packing underneath his coat. I mean.
Well, I think there is that moment when she's walking with Jonathan and she sees him behind them briefly before she goes off to get the film, I think. I think there's a moment of that, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he picks up the silverware for her and...
Which she doesn't get clean silverware.
Right? What the hell?
Disgusting East German floors.
Yeah, that's right. Way less clean than West German
floors. We're not trying to offend anybody in unified Germany at this point.
That's right.
But, I mean, the cafe they were in seemed kind of dirty.
It seemed really dirty.
Maybe we should just level our judgment on that particular establishment.
Yeah.
We would not want to eat from silverware that fell on the floor of that establishment.
I wouldn't want to eat
I wouldn't anywhere.
Exactly.
To be honest with
off
you.
My own floor, quite honestly.
Right.
I would just put that shit right back into the dishwasher and get some new shit.
Get some new stuff.
That's right. But anyway, she gives him strudel.
Right.
And he thinks that it's strudel that he's carrying across for her.
Right. We're meant to think it's not strudel.
So, so they eat and she takes notice of this guy and then they leave the restaurant and he's still following. And so she's like, "I'll meet you back up with you at the room. I got to go do something." And then we get this little chase scene and...
The randomest chase scene ever.
It is the randomest chase scene ever. And it also makes East Berlin look as if it's a ghost town.
Right.
There's like nobody there. There's just a bunch of empty buildings and just rubble everywhere, which, I mean, I'm sure there was some.
Sure.
But you would think that nobody lived in this place.
Well, I think they were trying to go.
In this entire town.
Exactly. I think they were trying to go for the impression of decrepit.
Yes.
Right?
Sure.
You know, land that time forgot.
Nothing
there since the 40s.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have to have abandoned buildings. It's the Soviet Union.
Sure.
Right?
Right. So, yeah, we get this little chase scene where she goes up into this abandoned building, up the stairs, and she follows. And then she goes out the window fire escape and down to the ground and manages to get away from him. And then I believe we then see her at some sort of pub with her contact.
Right.
And he explains that he's Vlad and that he's Russian and that he's very good or whatever. Her contact, too, interesting looking fellow.
Yeah, something about that nose
yeah.
did not feel right to me.
Yeah. So, and he's telling her to use the boy, which, in other words, use Jonathan to get the film across the border. So from here, we get that little scene. Then we get that little scene where Jonathan's hanging out at the schnitzel, the sausage place.
Yeah, she told him to go to
the place right by the hotel.
Yeah, the butcher by the hotel, and he's just sort of hanging out there.
Right. And we get Bond moment number two in this movie where he's like,
the name is Moore. Jonathan Moore. How's it going?
It's the worst rendition of the James Bond theme song ever.
Ever.
Probably because they didn't want to pay Monty any money for it.
Yes, they probably literally figured out how many keys off they needed to do so that it didn't quite sound like the James Bond theme. And I'm sure it was no coincidence that his last name was Moore and that at the time Roger Moore was playing James Bond. Yes. So yeah, we get that little moment, and then the East German guy comes up and is like, "What are you doing? Passports, you know? Let me
papers, please.
Papers, please. What are you doing? You know?" Jonathan's like, "You know what? She's probably not even showing up. I'm just gonna go back to the hotel now."
Then almost gets hit by a car.
Because he's looking the wrong way,
right?
Like tourists do. So he makes it back to the hotel, and then he gets a phone call from Sasha that he's to meet her on some sort of train going somewhere. So then he's on the train, then she shows up, and she's like, "Time to get out of here." And she gives him a kiss and puts her arms around him, and at the same time, she slips slips that little roll of film into his backpack without letting him know. Of course, she now has to head off somewhere else,
right?
Not come with him. So he goes back to the hotel, and that's when she does the whole meet me at the Cafe Friedrichstrasse thing. So yeah, he's got the directive that he now has to leave immediately without checking out, without doing anything in East Berlin. So he's now running to the, because at this point he's scared shitless.
Well, he tries to get in the car too, in that crappy whatever car.
Oh, that's right. And it doesn't start. And it won't start.
He leaves his rental car from West Germany in East Germany. I'm sure dad's going to be happy about that.
That's some American white boy shit right there. So yeah, he just leaves the friggin' car there and makes a run for the border. Makes a run for the border.
Which at this point in time would have been a Taco Bell commercial.
Dung.
Dung.
So he runs for the checkpoint. And in the meantime, we then see the little moment where Sasha gets picked up by Vlad and his gang. And then Jonathan winds up at the checkpoint. And of course, it's late at night. So the people at the DDR are very suspicious of him. So what happens? He gets strip searched, which I still wonder about whether or not that would really be a thing that would happen. Maybe it would. You know, I was not in East Berlin in the mid-80s, so I have no idea how.
Well, you're definitely at their mercy, so.
You certainly are, and you pretty much have to do whatever the hell they tell you to do. So he gets strip searched. And I love that little moment. Do you have committed serious crime? Pornography is.
Because he's got a Playboy in the back of his backpack.
Right, exactly. And so I love how Jonathan gets in, though. He's like, "Well, that's not pornography. That's art." He's like, "Of course it's pornography.
This will be confiscated."
Right. He's like, "Get dressed." And as he's getting dressed, the guy's checking out the Playboy.
He's flipping through it.
Yeah. So in the meantime, a curtain on a different strip search comes open, and we see that Sasha has been strip searched with a somewhat gratuitous moment there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're trying to give the indication that this is more serious, what's happening to her.
Yes, very much so, and that it's not a happy room. Nobody in that room is happy because the bad guys don't have what they want, and Sasha's definitely not happy. So that happens, and they suddenly realize that Jonathan must have the film.
Right.
So then Vlad goes hauling ass down the road, try and beat Jonathan through the checkpoint.
Right.
And
we get some kind of comic tension of getting him through with the whole, you know, one window, go to the next window, but it's the same lady at the first window.
Right. And the lady's very robotic and unfeeling and just, "Well, you need another visa day." And then he goes to the next window. "What do you want?" He's like, "I want another visa," you know.
And then, you know, she's getting through the gates and everything. Then she's, "Stop!" stop.
Right.
Why are you in such a hurry to leave DDR?
Your change.
You left your change. What he really should have done was just try to get through the checkpoint in a cello case.
Right? I mean,
or maybe through some high-powered sled in a water pipe system.
Yes.
Because both of those exist in East Germany, don't
totally,
they?
Totally. Totally.
Don't they?
Absolutely. So, yeah, he makes it through. And just after he makes it through, we see Vlad roll up to the checkpoint. He talks to the guy and he's like, I told so-and-so to stop this guy if he finds him. And the German guy's like, well, he didn't tell me anything about
that.
He's on break, so I don't know anything. And of course, we get that little, that's a very tropey thing too, the tension between the Russians and the Germans inside mm-hmm. East Germany, that whole thing. And then we get one of my favorite moments actually in the whole movie. Jonathan finally gets out and he's in West Germany, gets to the guard, the American guard.
Hey, how you doing?
Am I in West Berlin now?
Sure.
Fuck you!
Good night. I've been wanting to do that for the last 6 months.
So great. Even if it's corny and...
No, it you know, it feels like one of the most genuine moments in the film.
Yeah.
That a kid that was that stressed out.
Yeah.
At his age,
sure.
To get across, and his first thing would be to tell him to go fuck himself.
Exactly.
You know, that makes perfect sense to me.
And the second thing he would do is go to Burger King.
Which he does.
Which he does, and gets an American Whopper.
With American cheese.
And American fries.
And an American shake.
That's right. Which, again, accurate. Highly accurate.
Highly accurate.
So then we see Jonathan, he makes it back to the hotel, and he gets a phone call from Sasha telling him to meet him at some sort of the, like you said, the Spandau Ballet Castle.
It's the truest castle in Germany.
Of course. Oh, that's right. It's not even a phone call. It's just a message at the front desk.
Right, because he has to say, do you have any messages for Jonathan Moore?
Right, because the whole gig
Banachek.
Yeah, the whole Banachek name thing. So, and that is an actual castle. It's not really called the Spandau Ballet, but it's an actual castle in
that
Germany.
There's the word Spandau in it.
Somewhere, yeah. So
that much is true.
True! So, and of course, the hotel is trashed, and all his stuff is gone, and he goes down to the front desk, and the snooty guy behind the desk at the hotel is like, well, sorry, sucker, we're not responsible. And so Jonathan has to go sleep on the street.
Yeah, because his traveler's checks are gone.
Yeah.
Everything that he had is
all
gone.
His clothes. Yep. All he has is his passport and his plane ride home, which, interestingly enough, he must have had to try and cash in or something. Since he didn't fly out of the airport he was supposed to. Because that punk band was flying to, or was driving to Hamburg.
Yeah, that's true.
Not Spain.
That's true.
So... But anyway, that's just a little minor detail.
Yeah, you could do that kind of shit back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, he has to sleep on this park bench, which he's then, of course, woken up and told to move on. So he goes to this castle the next day or whenever it was that he's supposed to be there. And this woman is waiting for him, not Sasha, at the top of it. And she's like, Sasha gave you something. I need it. Sasha's in trouble. This is the only way to help her. Yada, yada, yada. So he thinks it's the strudel. So he tries to give her the strudel, and just then she gets shot by Vlad.
Inconceivably shot.
Inconceivably shot in broad daylight.
By a KGB agent.
In West Germany.
In West Germany.
With a giant sniper rifle with a silencer on the end of it.
But I think it's clear from this point on that our writer and director have no clue how any of that stuff actually happens.
Right.
Like zero research was actually done for determining how actual spycraft works, except for watching a couple of film noir movies from the 30s, 40s, or 50s.
Right. And said, well, that's of course how it happens.
Absolutely.
In you no way is the truth stretched at all.
No, this is clearly how it happens. We have we've watched movies. We know.
Yeah, yeah, we know. I am a consummate spy expert. As long as you just count movies. So she dies in his arms, and he suddenly realizes that she's been shot, and he's got blood all over his hands, and he's freaking out. So he makes a run for it, and they chase after him. And we get the little racy race thing through the castle area, all these little corridors under the bricks and everything. And we get to, you know, Jonathan gets to show off his gotcha skills.
That's right.
By running and hiding and, you know, double backing.
Everything short of parkour was happening here.
That's right. Until finally he's at the top of this thing where he's right at the wall by the moat, and he's... One guy's coming from one direction, and then Vlad comes out the door. And me and Jason both noted that there's an error in the continuity with Vlad's gun. Vlad initially comes out of the door, and he's holding a gun with a silencer on it. And by the time he shoots, there's no silencer on it. Or at least the audio has no...
It doesn't indicate there's a silenced pistol.
Right. So they're running after him, and he has nowhere to go except jumping into the moat. So that's what he does in almost a $6 million man, Steve Austin...
Slow motion.
Slow motion type moment. Yeah. So he jumps into the moat. I really wonder if... Anthony Edwards did it or not? Probably not.
Probably not.
It was a wide shot. You would have saw his face if it was really in. Anyway, so he jumps into the moat, and then so he's not like his buddy Tom in Top Gun. He's just...
Nope.
Nope.
This is where they clearly diverged in their careers.
That's right.
Tom would have made that jump.
Tom would have absolutely done the jump into the moat.
Anthony Edwards, not going to make
Not going to do that jump. So he jumps into the moat.
Although, to be fair, that character doesn't seem to have a whole lot of luck with falling into water. So...
Yeah. So...
I shouldn't say that character. That actor.
That actor.
Doesn't have a lot of luck playing characters who fall into water.
Yes.
Too soon. Rest in peace, Goose.
Love you, Goose. So he jumps into the moat, swims across, gets shot at, but somehow Vlad misses from not that far away. But of course, this is movies. So he runs away, makes it around the corner of something. I don't know where he's at in this area of Germany or whatnot, but he winds up at this area where there is a Volkswagen bus type thing that's spray painted, and these these David Bowie / Duran Duran / New Order type guys.
Very new wavy.
Very new wave, like new romantics era 1980s guys come out, and they're like, hey, can you get me to the airport? And they're like, no, we're going to Hamburg. We got a gig.
Oh.
And Jonathan, in his worry and haste, he tells them everything. He's like, these Russian guys are after me. I had to jump in the moat. And they're like, you jumped in the moat far out. He's like, sure, come on, man. So they all jump in this van. The name of the band is like, what is it called? Like
Cult Club or...
Yeah, Kook. It almost, it was like one step away from being something.
Right.
You don't want it to be. But...
Cool Cult.
That's right.
But it's K-U-L-K-U-L-T.
Yes, the Cool Cult. So he hops in the van with these band members that all have heavily makeup and their hair is all up and everything else.
Oh, and then lightning bolts and arrows painted on
their
face.
The driver looks like Bowie, man. So, well, nobody looks as good as Bowie. But,
correct.
But wants to look like Bowie. So they're driving. And there's a song playing. There's literally a song playing where you hear, what's your name? And then the very first thing that you hear inside the van, the girl goes, what's your name? It's like a little on the nose.
Some good timing going on there. Yeah.
So he's telling them, that it's just kind of a corny little moment, really, where he gets picked up by these guys. And they tell him that they have to go through the DDR to get to Hamburg for their gig. And Jonathan's freaking out because he doesn't want to go back there. So that's when they put all the makeup on him and make him look like one of them.
Yeah, buddy.
And a little fun fact that the real actors who played those band members had to use their actual passports when they do go to the DDR checkpoint. So that's fun. Must have been a budgetary thing. I don't know. So,
you know, you got to wonder what, because I mean, Jonathan gets a fake one.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't get an Anthony Edwards.
Maybe it was like, we don't have it in the budget. You guys have passports? Because everybody in Europe has a passport.
Yeah.
Because you go, it's like going to another state out there.
Yeah. So, yeah. So they go through and no suspicious looks from the guard. The guard just kind of shakes his head like, you crazy kids.
The use of the 80s. What is happening?
Yes, exactly. So then they drop him off at the airport. and never sees those guys again. And
hopefully they got to their gig. Okay.
I hope they did get to their gig because they were nice. Hamburg. They were nice fellows.
They were nice. Well, there was one girl too, but you know.
Yeah.
They were just seemed like a nice band that were just trying to get a start.
Yeah. So, interestingly enough, as soon as they show Jonathan in the airport, he took all the makeup off. All the makeup's gone now.
Like just, completely gone. Like
completely gone. He's just right back to normal. But anyway, next thing you know, we see him coming into America and he very happy about that. Gets home, puts his stuff down and a football comes through the window.
Well, don't forget, he's reminiscing.
Yeah.
Over his swag.
Yeah, he's got all the stuff out. And then he realizes he sees the roll of film and he's like, wait a minute, what the hell is that? He finally puts two and two together. And that's when the football comes through. And so he's got this like shell shock moment where he's freaking out because of all the stuff he had just been through. And then he realizes it's just a football. And at that point, when he throws it back to the fraternity guys outside, I had like a bit of Revenge of the Nerds deja vu.
Right.
Where they're like, hey, can you give us the football back? And I was waiting for the fraternity guy to go, nerd. Or whatever. So then he goes to his parents' house to drop off the camera and tell his parents about his great adventure.
Right.
And he gives us, I love how his dad is just like, all he cares about is the fucking camera.
Right.
He's like, great to see you, son. Where's my camera? My camera? Where's my camera? Where's my camera? That's all he cares about. So he gives him the camera. He takes the lens off the camera and water falls out of the camera. So he tells them the story. And I do find it interesting. They do this thing, this very, what I feel is like a lazy thing, where the parents immediately assume that Jonathan's on drugs. Now, I will say, the way that Jonathan tells the story to his parents is all over the place.
Right.
And does not accurately depict what actually happened. He's missing bits and pieces. He's clearly revisiting what happened in a very emotional sort of way.
Right.
So he's leaving out very like important details that would explain why he went from this place to this place to this place. Which could, I suppose, lead his parents to think that maybe he's on drugs. But I do feel like at the same time, this is kind of one of those things where they're just playing up the 80s schlock of parents who are kind of clueless. It's just an 80s trope. Yeah. Because the first thing they ask is like, you knocked a girl up, didn't you? You knocked the one girl up in Europe that's not on the pill.
He's telling him what the truth is, but the truth is so unbelievable to them that he must be on drugs.
Right, exactly.
Literally textbook 1980s bad script writing.
Right. So Jonathan, of course, gets mad and gets up in a huff and he leaves. And as he's driving home, he thinks he's being followed by some guy in a very fancy...
It's an old Mercedes from the 70s.
Yeah.
But he equates that to German KGB people.
Sure, even though I'm in LA now.
Right. We love it.
And of course, the music comes in, and there was that little hint too, because we did see that one little shot of Vlad coming through LAX.
Yeah.
So it leads the viewer to believe that, oh, maybe he is being tailed, but of course he's not being tailed.
Right.
And so then Jonathan runs this guy off the road, and the next thing you know, we see Jonathan on a payphone talking to. First, he calls the FBI.
The FBI then says, we don't handle any kind of that stuff here, which is not true.
They're like, why don't you try the CIA? Do you have their number? No, but it's in the book.
Right.
So then he calls the CIA, and just as he's getting the details out, he's got a gun in his face, basically, by the cops, who have now caught up to him for hitting and running the guy with the Mercedes.
Right. So let me digress here a little bit. So first of all, I don't think we mentioned that he ran the guy in the German car off the road. We didn't mention that.
Oh, okay.
But so he does, thinking he's being pursued, runs him off, goes to the payphone, goes to the whole thing. However, he calls the CIA. Now, I want to point out to you that it's nighttime in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Probably 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And he's calling the CIA, which is located in?
Langley, Virginia.
Which is in which time zone?
That'd be Eastern time.
That would be the Eastern time zone. And so would be how many hours ahead from California?
That would be 3.
So if we're talking about 8 o'clock, this would be?
11 o'clock.
11 o'clock. That's correct. Yes. And so somebody is answering the phone.
Yeah, like at it's like it's broad daylight.
Absolutely, they've got that hotline. You got some intrigue. Sure, call the intrigue hotline.
Oh, of course.
And
24/7.
24/7. You have microfilm? Check. Give us a call. You got a list? We love our list.
That's right.
Give us a call.
Got a micro dot?
Got a micro dot?
Love those too.
We love those too. Bring it all. Bring it all to us. Call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're ready to believe you. So he calls, and doesn't he ask for the address of the CIA in LA? He's trying to get the local office of the Central Intelligence Agency in Los Angeles.
He's like, what's your address? She's like, Langley, Virginia.
And then doesn't that lady actually end up being in LA?
Yeah.
So, and then of course there's a part where he's talking on the phone and the cop puts a gun to his head.
Right.
Now, LA was a little bit of the Wild West back in the 80s.
That's not enough. They would never do.
No, you would absolutely not.
Well, they did it for the shot.
But again, we're going to see more things where these people don't understand how police procedures work.
Right.
FBI procedures work.
CIA procedures work.
None of it.
Right.
And this is just the start. So you're going to hear some continual bitching from me from this point forward.
Indeed. So after Jonathan gets arrested, rightly so, for hitting and running the guy and running that guy off the road, his dad comes and picks him up.
Bails him out.
In his pajamas. In his pajamas, which I forgot to mention, my favorite outfit of the dad is the jumpsuit at the beginning of the film.
Oh, absolutely.
Such a great
brown
jumpsuit. Anyway, but yeah, he's in his pajamas picking up his son at the police department. And he's mad because he knows that this guy is going to sue him, not Jonathan, because he knows that dad is the one with the money.
And we kind of get that sort of conciliatory moment, you know, between the dad and the kid.
Yeah, he's like, you're a good kid, but you just need help or whatever.
Right. But it really just falls right back on the get some help with those drugs, Jonathan thing.
Yeah, the whole I'm still a clueless parent that doesn't really know what's going on.
Exactly.
So yeah, he goes home, his house is ransacked, and he realizes that they're all looking for the film. So he calls the CIA, he's like, I want to come in, you know, I have the film, and so they're like, we believe you, here's the address, come on in, because the CIA would certainly just give you the address like that. So then he comes in, and first of all, you walk into the CIA, allegedly,
right,
that's in Los Angeles, allegedly, and there's a giant 2-foot circular placard thing of the logo for the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, because, you know, we're going to completely advertise the covert operation that our agency that cannot operate in the United States of America.
Right.
We're going to put that sign right there.
That's right. I mean, it literally looked like a real estate agency.
It totally did. Cubicles and all.
Yeah. Even the lady that helped him.
Right. And she was straight out of beep. Just a moment. Thank you for calling the Central Intelligence Agency. Just a moment.
So he's waiting there to talk to somebody, and he sees Sasha walking with two other agents, wearing shoulder holsters, I might add.
Yeah, everybody in the CIA is packing heat.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's what you do for an agency that, once again, is not allowed to function in the United States of America. They're all packing heat.
That's right.
Because the FBI doesn't do that stuff.
Of course not. So I also find it really dubious that somehow she doesn't see him.
Right.
She's like in broad daylight in this hallway. And she somehow, being an agent of the CIA, doesn't notice in her periphery
the guy that
she's been sleeping with for the past 2 weeks.
Right. You know, she didn't notice that the KGB agent that knocked over silverware was a KGB agent.
That's right. Well, you know.
And we all do. We don't even have any CIA training.
That's right.
He looked like a CIA or a KGB agent.
Right. So he sees her, and then he takes off, and then he goes into covert gotcha mode and follows Sasha around, who's chumming it up with one of her fellow agents.
Right.
And I just think it's funny that he's wearing these big aviator glasses, which make him stand out more than if he just didn't have glasses on at all. Like, it actually makes him even more conspicuous as he's following.
Without the glasses, he would have totally blended in wherever he was at.
Right.
But with the glasses on, he's like, oh, look at that douche trying to be Tom Cruise.
So he goes back home only to find some of the CIA guys there. And they're still searching through his shit because he still has the film after he saw Sasha. He booked it. So he sees the CIA guys rifling through all his shit and he hides behind like another bush. He's really good at hiding behind bushes. He's
very good at hiding behind a bush.
Yeah. He waits there behind the bush. And the CIA guys, they leave his place. And then he goes up in there and he's just like kind of sitting there. And then Manolo rocks up and he's like, what happened in here? And he tells the whole story and tells him that the CIA was the one who did this to his apartment, that they were looking for this roll of film. And he tells him all about his adventure with Sasha. And of course, he's like, I kind of knew something like this was going to happen.
I knew something like this was going to happen.
I had a feeling.
You know, because like it does in the real world.
That's right. This happens to everyone. So while they're sitting there having their talk, Sasha calls him and then, you know, she wants to meet at some place or come to him or whatever it is. But at this point, Jonathan's not having it.
You're doing it my way.
That's right. You're doing it my way. And he puts her on hold. And
yeah, the hold by putting the hand over the receiver portion of the telephone.
Yes, because... Sure. I mean, honestly, those old school phones, that probably would do it.
It absolutely did, as long as you were talking at full vocal level, which he was.
Which he was. So he then puts the phone to the side and says to Manolo, are you still a homeboy? Meaning, are you still a gang member?
And he's like, once a homeboy, always a homeboy.
Right.
I think it's an oversimplification of how the gang family dynamic works, but we're going to run with it.
We're going to run with it. So then apparently the homeboys are going to do Jonathan a little favor. And then Jonathan's like, meet me at such and such place in an hour, which feels like, man, those homeboys, they work quickly. You know, the operation took shape.
Well organized.
Well oiled machine, those fellows.
Absolutely.
They had everything in order almost immediately.
It's almost like they had a backup plan for this in case one of the homeboys needed that help.
That's right. They needed an escape out of a Chinese prison.
Exactly. We need to execute homeboy emergency plan 17 Alpha.
Dinner out.
Dinner out.
So then Sasha and two of her little goon friends are waiting at this flower shop on this corner. And this lowrider comes rocking up and is like, hey, Sasha, if you want to meet Jonathan, go to such and such and such and such. So then they're at some place where there's a bunch of Mexican restaurants and stuff. And we get into all this hacky humor that's based on stereotypes and stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
It's so bad. Where the two CIA agents that are not Sasha are wearing big sombreros. And there's mariachi music playing. It's just, it's so corny. So, and then there's a guy in a chicken suit who hands her a flyer that tells her where to go next. So then they're in Chinatown and then they play up all the bad Chinese stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the two CIA goons are now eating Chinese out of a takeout box with chopsticks. And some old Chinese man walks up and like says, you know, El Mercado and go over here. She goes to the El Mercado, and then Manolo rolls up in his fancy, what was it, a Charger?
A Dodge Charger GT Turbo, baby.
Oh, yeah, baby. And he's like, get in. So she gets in, and they take off. And, of course, the two CIA guys are chasing after him. And that's when we get that big blaring, I think that's another Frankie Goes to Hollywood song.
Yes.
That, when two sides go to war. They're hauling ass down this high-speed chase down an alleyway. And suddenly the lowrider that you saw earlier is now behind the CIA car. And they pass a certain area. And then all these other cars roll up and kind of stop the CIA car in their tracks. And everybody gets out. And the CIA guys, they break out their badges and their... And,
of which they don't have badges.
Yeah.
Nor should they be carrying firearms under their coats.
Right.
But...
And I felt like that whole moment was just built up just so they could let Manolo say, we don't need no stinking badges.
Correct.
I feel like that whole scene, unfortunately, was just to get that stupid line out. Like, so hacky.
Yeah.
Just...
Well, you know what the problem was here is because of the nature, maybe this is because of that script change for the third act, but they now had to have Linda Fiorentino's character. They had to add Sasha in a position where you had to be able to identify who she was.
Yeah.
And realistically, the FBI would have been the place to go for this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Not the CIA.
Right.
But because the FBI doesn't run counterintelligence operations, like, technically they do, but they...
Oh, they do.
But they don't, for the interest of the 80s.
Yes.
It's not something that they do as robustly as a CIA would.
Sure.
So you couldn't have her coming back as a FBI agent. Although, honestly, I guess you could have, considering how much the writer actually gave a shit about any of this.
Right.
You could have just said she was an FBI agent that was running out there, too.
Right.
For that matter. But... it's funny that they had to kind of shoehorn all of this together, but they still needed to be able to have guys with guns on her side that had to get caught by the gang members on the other side.
Right, with all of their guns.
Right.
So we get the gang members that hold up the CIA guys, and then Manolo takes off with Sasha to go meet Jonathan.
Back at campus.
Back at campus, of course. So now we're back at UCLA campus, and she walks up to... some statue or whatever, and Jonathan's there, and he basically makes her come clean, and she reveals that she's Cheryl Brewster.
Hey, Brewster.
Cheryl Brewster, the spy from
Pittsburgh.
I was gonna say Cincinnati, but Pittsburgh.
No, it's the what was it from Cincinnati? The chicken from Cincinnati, the giant chicken heart from Cincinnati. That's what it was.
And so just as they're trying to sort of hash things out and find out what's going, you know, how each other feel or whatever, there's a gunshot on campus.
Which shoots the statue's boob.
That's right. And it's Vlad somehow.
Damn you, Val Vlad, with your boob shooting pistols.
That's right. And so another foot chase ensues. And of course, even though the viewer already knows it, of course, Jonathan then has to say it out loud. Well, you're on my turf now, so I'm going to... take charge, and, you know, I know what to do. So right. So now we're headed to the veterinary department or, you know, school. And he runs down and goes, get that tranquilizer gun.
Put them trank darts in you without any covers on them.
Yeah, no covers on the darts.
Let's don't fall down real hard. You're going to go to sleep for a long time.
For a long time, maybe forever, given how many of those darts were in his pocket.
Oh, shit.
So he gets the tranquilizer dart gun and takes off. And then there's a little bit more of a chase. And
that's what it is. He actually tells her, go get your buddies.
Go get your buddies.
I'll lead them away kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So while he's leading the bad guys away and he starts employing his gotcha skills because he knows the campus so well, he takes out a couple different Russian baddies.
He takes out Popeye the Sailor Russian. He takes out weird curly hair Russian.
He takes out the guy that looks kind of like, what's his face from Cheers?
Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah.
I did not get a Kelsey Grammer vibe from the guy that he zapped. No.
The thinner bald guy? No.
That's fair.
Kelsey Grammer. But anyway, he takes out a couple different guys because he knows the campus so well. And he
can shoot a dart gun like a mofo.
That's right. He is a tenured gotcha agent.
Correct.
So then he's coming down the stairs. And sure enough, Vlad has Cheryl in his clutches with his gun to his head.
She didn't quite make it to the CIA, guys.
That's right. So at this point, Vlad tells Jonathan to put the gun down. And just then, that old that guy with the jean jacket and the jeans and all the jeans.
He's out of bubble gum again,
But he sees Jonathan and he's got his gotcha gun on him. So he's going to take a shot. So he shoots Jonathan, which distracts Vlad just enough that Jonathan can fall to the ground, grab his tranquilizer gun.
F-a-two, right into the heart.
F-a-two. And down goes Vlad.
Sorry, Vlad. That was some very fast acting trank, by the way.
Yeah, right. So fast acting that Vlad couldn't even get a shot off.
Nope. And you forget the fact that it's shot into his sternum, which is virtually impossible to pierce.
Right.
And that dart that deep would have probably gone into his heart and caused heart damage and probably killed him. I mean, forget all of that. Down goes Vlad. Maybe Vlad was dead. We don't really know that.
I mean, in the very next scene, when the other two CIA guys show up, there is an ambulance in the background.
That's true.
So maybe he survived, maybe he didn't.
I don't know.
It's hard to say.
I feel like he's going to jail, though.
Oh, I definitely think he's going somewhere bad.
Espionage.
Maybe Guantanamo.
I don't know, but I bet you he needs to get arrested by the FBI.
So, you know, Sasha's, or sorry, it's getting so hard to get the names correct.
Cheryl.
So Cheryl shows up.
Say that three times fast.
So her buddies show up and Jonathan kind of tosses them the film and then walks away. And the two CIA guys are like, "You're a hero," or something like that. He's like, "Yeah, the next time I need my apartment
redecorated,
I'll call you guys," or whatever.
Right.
So Jonathan walks away with Cheryl, and we kind of get this little makeup scene.
Yeah, lovey-dovey. Lovey-dovey. I really do like you, and, you know, you're awesome.
Right. And I forgot to mention earlier that the first time that they meet, before Vlad shows up, she drops the accent.
Right.
So now she's speaking with an American accent. So while she's trying to say that she still wants to be with him and whatnot at the very end of this movie, you know, she's talking in her normal American accent, but then he starts walking away and she goes, "I know," in that Czechoslovakian accent. And we get a moment of fourth wall breaking where Jonathan looks straight into camera and stops for her, because it's like, well, who wouldn't stop for her?
Right.
So, and I mean, let's be honest, the accent plays. It would play for me. That's all I'm saying.
It's not the best accent I've ever heard.
It's not, but I, you know what? If I was Jonathan Moore in the world of Jonathan Moore.
At 18,
I'd be like.
Solid.
I'd be like, use the accent again. But that's pretty much the end of the movie, except it's not, even though it should be.
Should have been the end of the movie.
This is another huge, this is maybe the thing that I hate the most in this movie, is this final, Mr. Canoe just could not let it go. He couldn't let this stupid thing go with the girl at the beginning of the movie.
Nope.
Who got the thing on her stupid sweater that nobody gives a shit about at this point in the movie. The ending should just be Jonathan walking off into the sunset with Cheryl.
Cheryl.
That's it. Cheryl. That should be it. But no, he's walking on campus. He's like, "Hey, how's your sweater?" And she's like, "Get lost, you creep." And he just can't help himself. He's got to commit assault.
Yep. He's still got one dart left.
He's still got the dart gun.
And Cheryl is nowhere to be seen anymore.
Right. She's just gone. Just gone. So he's like, "Get lost, you creep. I think I'm going to shoot you in the ass with this dart gun, which will then make you fall on your face, probably break some teeth."
Yep. And, you know, I was saying we were coming back to the undisclosed location and sorting this out. All they really needed to make that at least fit was you get a kiss with Linda Fiorentino, hand on the face. "I have to go back to work, but I'll call you later." Mm-hmm. She goes off and he's walking. He's still got the gun. And then the girl walks by while he's on campus. Yeah. And then he does it.
Right.
It's still stupid. It's still pointless.
But at least then you'd have continuity. But at least
it makes sense. Exactly. Right.
Even though a far better, well, the best ending would never to be see that girl again.
Exactly.
Never to see that girl again.
But if you need to get that into it.
If you just felt the need to show that girl again, show him walking with Cheryl past her,
right,
and not giving two shits that she's right there.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many other ways to handle
So many other ways to handle
Have we also investigated the possibility that maybe that girl was dating the director?
Who knows? I mean, don't know. All I know is that I think visually, Jeff Canoe wanted the image of a girl's butt with a dart in it. That's all he wanted.
Which he got.
Which he got, but it's at the expense of just, it basically makes Jonathan look like he hasn't learned a goddamn thing.
It totally does.
It just makes him look like almost like a fucking incel.
The whole point of this movie is to go from being this stupid,
young, naive
nerd to a seasoned, eye-defeated KGB agents kind of guy.
Right, who's now has some confidence, who now feels good about himself, who's not going to waste his time with some girl that's you know, mean to everybody.
Right.
But, you know, good job, Jeff.
For the kind of movie it is, it kind of makes sense.
I suppose so. Good job, Jeff.
Good job, Jeff.
And that is the movie.
That is the movie.
That is Gotcha. Jason, final thoughts?
I'll never watch this again, I think. I also think Linda Fiorentino. Wow.
Yeah. I must admit, I think purely for nostalgia and not because it's a good movie, I will probably watch it again. Also, I own it. I literally have the Blu-ray. So I will watch it again, probably more for Linda Fiorentino than anything else.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? I read on Wikipedia, actually, that Roger Ebert, when he was doing his review of this movie, that he said that this movie had the capability to be a much better movie, but wasn't. And he talked about how it would have been much more interesting in the third act to follow Linda Fiorentino's character rather than follow Jonathan home, which I wholeheartedly agree with. Could you imagine if they could have developed the spy?
Oh, yeah.
If they could have developed the spy end of the story so that you got a little bit more depth and in like something real, something more than just Jonathan discovering a roll of film with quote unquote spy shit on it. You know what I mean?
Right. But it's the man with the one red shoe.
It is. Right. It is.
It's not about, it's about the main character.
It's a romantic comedy with a tinge, with a heavy tinge of spy movie.
Yeah.
Attached to it.
I think
and that's
that
all that it is.
If somebody took this concept, sold it to Amazon Prime and made an 8-episode series of it, you know, that you could take the comedy bits out. Kind of like what they're doing with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I feel like.
Yeah.
They're trying to make it a more serious. They're still going to be comedy. When you look at the two actors that are in there.
Yeah.
But they aren't going to play it for comedy like the movie was with Brad and Angelina. Right. I think you could do that successfully with this as well.
I think you absolutely could. Because there's a good story in there.
Right.
It's a good premise for a movie.
You just need to remove the 80s hijinks type of film aspect from it and treat it as what it could be treated as a serious movie.
Right. Like I said, I'll probably watch it again just because nostalgia, and it, you know, was one of those movies that hit me at the right time. But I think if I had seen this movie 10 years later, I would be in the exact same opinion that you are, that I would never watch this movie again.
Hey, you know, I'm not going to think any less of you if you do.
I appreciate that. But what did you think of the movie? Tens of listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts or insights, or if we've missed anything, or if we've said anything incorrectly, if there were some bits of truth that weren't truths,
please. So a lack of truthiness?
That's right. A lack of truthiness. Please get in touch, because if there's one thing we're always telling you, we love listener interaction. So on email at cicdeaddrop@gmail.com, on Instagram at Central Intelligence Cinema, separated by underscores, or on Twitter, it's at @CICSpyPod. And there's a whole bunch of other ones that you can find at the bottom of the show description of this very episode. So please, say hi. Do something like that. We'd appreciate it.
Please.
Please. Also, if you're enjoying the podcast, we would love it if you would choose to help us out by giving us a glowing 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or just tell a friend about us. Just say, hey, these goofy, I've been listening to these two goofy guys. They're just talking shit in some undisclosed location about spy movies. Is pretty fun. You should listen to it. They're called CIC. Let the people know about us. But any last thoughts, Jason? I'll take that as a no. And with that, I'm Ben.
And I'm Jason.
And the CIC will return with more missions, more martinis,
and more mayhem.
And weirgins.